Kavanaugh and the global Me Too conversation today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. Senate's handling of the sexual assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh is definitely making news around the globe. In Sweden, for example.
The Kavanaugh hearing is seen as a big Me Too movement in Sweden, and we follow everything that has to do with Me Too very thoroughly because it's a big thing in Swedish politics.
And there are echoes as well in India.
For instance, the hashtag that's trending in the U.S., Why I Didn't Report, has gained a lot of momentum here as well. And Indian women are speaking up much, much louder than they did even with the Me Too hashtag that was big earlier.
The global impact of the fight over Kavanaugh, that's coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World.
Call the roll.
Mr. Grant, Mr. Cornyn, Mr. Lee.
They did it. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted along party lines 11 to 10 to back Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court. The full Senate still has to act. There's a lot at stake. Here's Senator Dianne Feinstein.
The entire country is watching now how we handle these serious allegations. It is, in fact, a real test for the United States Senate. And for our country to see how we treat women, especially women who are survivors of sexual assault.
The story is making headlines around the world in places like Sweden and Brazil, where people are debating some of these same issues. Kesa Buglund is a Washington correspondent for Swedish National Radio. Julia Zaremba de Camara e Silva also covers D.C. and the U.S. for Folha de São Paulo, one of Brazil's largest dailies. And there are reasons both of you have been paying close attention to the Kavanaugh hearings and the charges made against the judge by Christine Blasey Ford. Julia, let me start with you. You're covering the nomination for Brazilian readers. Why is the story resonating there?
I think, first of all, the story is important for us because of all the women issues. And in Brazil, we're ahead of one of the most important elections in our history. And we have a candidate that is a front runner that is not very popular among women.
That candidate is Jair Bolsonaro. He's the one who was recently stabbed. What are the issues that women have with him, and how is that reflected in the Kavanaugh hearings?
Yeah, there's actually a campaign in the social media where women are saying not him. He has some positions that are seen as misogynist. Like, he told once to a congresswoman that he wouldn't rape her because she didn't deserve it. And they're
commenting on her looks, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of complicated. He's really not popular among women. And it's really important. I think one of the things that has more to do in all this Kavanaugh hearing confirmation process with Brazil has to do with the abortion, because in Brazil, the abortion isn't legalized. And they're having a lot of discussions about it in the country.
And Kesa Buglund, what about in Sweden? Because it seems like the country is having its own debate about sexual assault and harassment, and which claims are credible.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the Kavanaugh hearing is seen as a big Me Too movement in Sweden, and we follow everything that has to do with Me Too very thoroughly because it's a big thing in Swedish politics too. And we have had, I think we have been proud of being a progressive country with a lot of equality between men and women. We have dads taking care of the kids, cooking food, stuff like that maybe my dad's generation didn't do as much. But when this Me Too movement came about, it was also clear that in the field of sexual assaults, we haven't been doing as good as we maybe thought we had. And we are just a couple of days ago, we had a very famous Swedish man taken to custody. He is a person that is connected to the Swedish Academy, the institution that selects the Nobel Prize in Literature.
Right.
And he has been obviously being harassing women sexually for years and years. Rumor has it that he even did it to our crown princess, and no one ever told the police. So it's something about women speaking out that is really resonates in Sweden. But also I have to say this thing with Kavanaugh, that it's really a he said, she said situation that also resonates with the Swedish debate over what do we do with all the information that comes out when women start to speak out, and what do we do in those cases where we never maybe will know the truth because someone is denying it, someone is accusing. So it's also an important moment in that sense to follow.
Yeah, and Kay, so what did you hear in yesterday's testimony from either Dr. Ford or from Kavanaugh that you picked up on and thought that will be relevant to Swedes back home?
It was really the thing that both of them seemed so sure about their version. So it's really, really difficult to say what is the truth here. It was also interesting, I think, that they had very almost stereotypes ways of presenting themselves. She really wanted to be helpful and said that all the time.
Does that work for you? Does that work for you as well?
We're here to accommodate you, not
you accommodate us. I'm used to being collegial. So.
Okay, go ahead.
And he was more aggressive, but also very sure of himself.
I have never done this to her or to anyone. That's not who I am. It is not who I was. I am innocent of this charge.
And still also crying, which is interesting because Swedish men never cry in public. Those were some of the things that we picked up on.
I mean, the Swedish government has made gender equality a priority. Has the fact that the Kavanaugh nomination has gone this far after several allegations, has that surprised Swedes?
Yes, in some sense. If we have had an FBI investigation that really showed that he had done this, that would surprise Swedes unbelievably much if he was to be confirmed. Now we have this situation where we will never know, and I think Swedes are aware of that. We can't be 100% sure that she was the one telling the truth, so I'm not so sure about if maybe it wouldn't be very different in Sweden. But one thing that is different is that it's strange for us to see a parliament or a congress with almost only men in the panel, only men on the Republican side. That wouldn't really work in Swedish policy.
What about some of the arguments that we've been hearing here about, you know, Kavanaugh, that boys will be boys and this happened in the past and, you know, what do you expect kind of thing? I mean, does that sound familiar?
Yeah, we have had so much discussions about this in Sweden lately because I think we thought that we were better at this. But with the Me Too movement and so many young women coming out, I have been surprised and many people have been surprised over how big this problem has is still going on. And so even though we have had a lot of discussion and talks a lot about it in Swedish schools that you shouldn't do anything without the other partner's consent, etc., it's so obvious that we still have a long way to go.
Most of the times in Brazil too, the victims are discredited and people don't believe in what they say. And I think it really is a reality in Brazil not to believe in women lots of times.
What's been the hardest part of the story to convey to your audiences in your countries? Let me start with you, Kesa.
I think Swedes have, in many cases, problems with understanding on a deeper level Republicans and this longing for conservatism. I also should say that we now have a party in Sweden, in the Swedish Riksdag, our parliament, that is more social conservative and a little bit more like this. It's also a parallel to what Julia was saying about abortion. We have, I mean, abortion rights has been It has been a no-go zone for politicians to even question that right. But now we have this social conservative far-right party that is questioning to some degree women's right to abortion. So that's also maybe playing into it. But the overall idea of this conservative judge coming in with so much potential power is something that many Swedes really think is a strange idea.
Yeah, and I'm wondering whether what happens with this vote, the outcome, it sounds like it could have an effect on the debates going on in your own countries. Julia, am I wrong?
I don't know exactly what can happen, but I think the abortion thing will be one thing that will catch the attention of the Brazilians. That would be one of the consequences, the possibility to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Yeah, Brazilians will be watching that carefully if that should come up. Kesa, what do you think? Could the outcome of this vote affect what's going on in Sweden?
The majority of the Swedes are very skeptical to Donald Trump, and this will be another sign of him picking a person like this and also him getting confirmed, even with all those question marks hanging over him. That will be one more thing that Swedes will make Sweden think that USA is a little bit of a strange country right now.
That was Kesa Boglund with Swedish National Radio. You also heard from Julia Zaremba da Camara e Silva with the Brazilian daily Folha de São Paulo. As the hearings in the Senate were taking place yesterday, calls to the National Sexual Assault Hotline shot up more than 200%. When survivors of sexual assault speak publicly about their experiences, that can spur others to come forward. It can also be a very difficult time for survivors. Abra Poindexter is a psychotherapist based in Omaha, Nebraska. I asked her to describe how all of this attention on the Kavanaugh hearings and the talk of sexual assault can be triggering.
A trigger is a stimulating event that actually triggers an involuntary response on the part of a survivor. The trigger itself can be anything. It can be a sight, a smell, a sound, and the response is geared actually by our limbic brain to material that mimics or feels like or is experienced like an original traumatic event.
If you have not experienced this kind of trauma, what is the frame of reference for understanding the trigger?
Most people have experienced either a near miss of a car accident or a car accident in their lifetime. And people during the course of the accident or just after can describe feeling like they're shaking, like they have a brief loss of memory, maybe don't remember the impact or don't remember certain faces. And then they can remember the next time they attempted to get into a car, their body involuntarily reacting to that. Their hands might have been shaking or they might have had second thoughts about getting into the car. Or they might have gotten in the car, started driving just like any other day, and once they're driving, they see a car coming toward them, and it's a completely safe situation, but the way that they feel is as if they are in danger. That's what a trigger feels like to a survivor of assault.
I can imagine, though, that it's not just the coverage that triggers survivors. I mean, couldn't it just be like overhearing a conversation at work at the water cooler?
Absolutely. It's incredibly triggering. An event like this is surrounding us. I mean, everyone is talking about it. It's on every media outlet. I've had multiple clients this week who have asked me to help them figure out what would be a safety plan for them so that they can opt out of the coverage. Probably the most prominent reactions I've had so far have been the responses to actually watching Kavanaugh's testimony because of the rage that he expressed. And what that looks like and feels like to people who've experienced sexual assault. So as you can imagine, it can be multiple triggers actually happening all at once.
Abra Poindexter, a psychotherapist based in Omaha, Nebraska. Thanks very much for the advice. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, here's a number for the National Sexual Assault Hotline. It's 1-800-656-HOPE. You can also find that number on our Facebook page. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. There's a connection between New York City and Greenland that we've been talking about this week in the past couple of days on the show through climate change, melting ice, and sea level rise. Reporter Janet Babin, who lives in New York, went to Greenland to look into it. She wanted to find out what scientists are learning about the island's history and what it could mean for the future of her hometown. Here's Janet on the last day of her trip.
I've been right up near the Greenland ice sheet for 5 days now, and I feel surprisingly like a camping pro. We've slept in tents through the never-ending daylight, anchored catamarans in icy lakes, and trudged up and down the glacial moraines searching for rock samples. Now it's time to step onto the vast ice sheet itself. But first, the team wants to map the area to find the safest path.
It really comes in hot.
That's the team's drone. Drones are revolutionizing fieldwork. They can map topography in minutes that would have taken hours to figure out on foot.
Okay, got it.
With the drone info in hand, we begin to angle our ascent over the steep terrain that's covered with loose rocks. The landscape is so unstable, every step is a gamble. The wind doesn't help. But after a last push across a rushing glacial river, we're finally walking on ice.
I mean, first of all, how cool is it that we're just like standing on the Greenland ice sheet? It's pretty incredible.
That's Jason Briner, our trip co-leader and geology professor at the University at Buffalo.
So we're standing on bare ice. So if you walk around, you can hear the crunch because this ice that we're standing on might be 10,000 years old.
For most of the last few days, Briner and his colleagues have been sampling older rocks, hoping their chemistry and location will provide clues to the history of Greenland, how warm or cold it was at particular times throughout history, and how much ice was there. Today, though, Briner is sampling the younger moraines, piles of rock and other glacial sediment that have built up right next to the ice sheet.
And it's like an example of what the landscapes that we normally study would have looked like thousands of years ago. So it's actually really useful for us to calibrate our eye and to understand the processes of how moraines get deposited, that kind of thing.
Briner hopes that by mining this geologic history, he and other scientists can help create better computer models of Greenland's future in a warming world and what it might mean for sea level rise. The team spends hours on the moraine gathering rock samples. We also take in the majesty of the ice, stretching out for miles, and peer into crevasses that plunge deep beneath the ice we're walking on. Then we make cocoa.
Well, after we drink hot cocoa, how are we going to get out of here?
We cross back over the rushing waterfalls and fast-moving glacial lakes. We navigate piles of rock debris. After a few hours, we make it back to camp, tired, punchy, and hungry.
Good day. Should we order pizza? $12,000 pizza delivery.
We need to allocate a few of those chopper hours.
A chopper is arriving in a while, but there will be no pizza for now. Instead, we're all shipping out. Briner and the other researchers are heading to another part of Greenland, and I'm heading home to New York and my first shower in a week. Those 5 days on the ice margin flew by, but science happens slowly. So the research team from the trip is still analyzing its data for any new conclusions about the ice sheet and for any new clues as to what might be ahead for my city. Meanwhile, though, I'm still wrestling with the impact of some of the team's earlier findings, and so are they.
That's the first data set ever that keeps me awake at night at times because it is so alarming.
Jörg Schaefer at Columbia University's Earth Institute is one of Jason Briner's lead collaborators. A groundbreaking study this team published 2 years ago came to a striking conclusion that Greenland has been nearly ice-free for a substantial part of the last million years, that in a climate similar to today's, the ice sheet all but completely melted away. Schaefer says that cuts against what we thought we knew about Greenland.
We don't understand this, how this can happen. And given the extreme warming of the Arctic that's going on and given these really worrisome signs of the Greenland ice sheet that we observe today, this is a really scary story.
A total Greenland meltdown would raise sea levels by roughly 25 feet. Schaefer says he's not scared that will happen anytime soon. Other researchers aren't sure it will happen at all. But Schaefer says even half a foot of sea level rise from Greenland is possible by the end of the century. And he says that would be a disaster for society. But it would still be a creeping disaster, too slow to register in most people's daily lives, except when the coast gets hit by big storms.
And so when those happen, if sea level rise is higher, the damage done to a place like New York is much greater and costlier.
That's Nicholas Young, also at Columbia University's Earth Institute. He was a co-leader on my Greenland trip and also took part in that earlier research. And what he's talking about has already begun to happen, like when Superstorm Sandy slammed New York with record flooding back in 2012. Sandy was supposed to be a wake-up call for what we know is coming as polar ice melts and sea levels rise. And since then, promises have been made and millions spent in New York to try to soften the blows of future storms over a rising sea. But progress has been very slow. Back up in Greenland, I asked Young whether he's frustrated that the results of all this research he and others are doing doesn't seem to be sinking in.
Do you ever wish you could, like, talk to the New York City officials and be like, guys, listen?
Yeah, sure. I mean, at this point, I think they know what the potential problems are going to be, but it's just an issue of rerouting dollars. I mean, it's going to be expensive. No one wants to pay for it until they absolutely have to.
After I came back from Greenland, I moved out of Brooklyn down to Wall Street in Manhattan, part of the city that flooded during Sandy. Looking around, not much has changed. A few towers moved their electrical systems to higher floors, and the city has rebuilt some parks to hold more water during storms. And there's talk of bigger changes. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers recently began holding public meetings on whether to build berms, seawalls, and storm surge barriers along New York's shoreline. But those plans would take decades and billions of dollars to implement. I went to Greenland to try to get a better fix on how the future of the ice sheet could affect my city. And what I learned is that while details will continue to evolve, we know enough already that we should probably be doing a lot more to protect coastal cities from climate change and sea level rise. For now, though, I head on over to the local bodega to stock up on flashlights and bottled water. After all, it is hurricane season again. For The World, Janet Babin, New York.
Janet's reporting was supported by the National Science Foundation, the New York Air National Guard, and the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources. You can check out her entire series and photos from her trip to Greenland at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Nikolai Vasin was a major counterculture figure in Russia and a groupie. He was known as the Soviet Union's number one Beatles fan. He believed in the power of rock and roll.
Rock and roll opened the whole world to us. It tore down the Iron Curtain.
Nikolai Vasin's story, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, cleared a major hurdle today. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted yes on his nomination, 11 to 10. But Americans are still digesting what played out on Capitol Hill yesterday. Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh spent hours testifying. What was said by Ford and Kavanaugh and by U.S. senators shined a light not only on the political divisions in this country, but also on the divide between genders and generations in 2018 America. India is having its own reckoning over issues related to gender and violence against women, and the Supreme Court there has been playing an active role, recently overturning a number of archaic laws that codified discrimination against women. Plus, the Me Too movement is ramping up in the country in various ways. We caught up with journalist Chavi Suchdev earlier today. She spoke with us via Skype while out on the streets of Mumbai. Chavi says the Kavanaugh confirmation and the allegations against the nominee have gotten attention in India.
For instance, the hashtag that's trending in the U.S., why I didn't report, has gained a lot of momentum here as well. And Indian women are speaking up much, much louder than they did even with the Me Too hashtag that was big earlier.
Well, it's interesting because the hearings and the accusations of sexual assault by Dr. Ford against Brett Kavanaugh is in the context of the Me Too movement. Is the Me Too movement growing in India, getting traction, and how is it expressing itself?
So it is definitely gaining traction. I think there are a lot of debates happening offline. I'm hearing about people who are trying to talk to their colleagues who are asking the same questions that, you know, the Republican Party is asking when there are ways that people look to discredit survivors. Why didn't they report it earlier? Why do they keep quiet for so long? And people are trying to address this in a cogent manner. They're looking at other women to support them, to make people understand why they're not reporting them. The Me Too movement has also resulted in something interesting that happened just in the last 2 days. Bollywood has been very silent about the Me Too movement, unlike Hollywood. And two accusations in the last 2 days naming prominent actors have made it into the news. Again, people are asking why the actresses did not report this earlier. Mm. And there's a lot of debate happening about that.
There are also interesting developments going on in India's Supreme Court, tangentially related to the Me Too movement. One has to do with adultery. Tell us about that.
That's right. In India, for the last almost 160 years, a man having an affair with a married woman without the consent of her husband was committing a crime. The other people involved were not. And that whole thing has been struck down because the Supreme Court ruled that this reading of the law makes it sound like a woman is an object that is under the control of her husband. And so they've struck down the adultery law altogether, giving all humans agency over their sexuality and whatever they choose to do in or out the bedroom.
And what about Indian women? Can they still be charged with adultery?
They never could be. It was never a woman's crime. So now it's an equal playing field and nobody's a criminal. It's really a personal matter.
So there is a lot going on under this theme of gender equality in India. There was another law overturned just today in India's highest court, overturning a ban that sounds very archaic, a law that banned women of menstruating age from entering Hindu temples. Elaborate on that.
So until today, the priests at this really important temple in South India called the Sabarimala had disallowed women from the age of 10 to 50, because when you're menstruating, you are polluting the sanctity of the temple, from entering the temple. And the Supreme Court has today said that women are not children of a lesser god and they can enter any temple they choose and they can't be barred from it.
Was that law ever actually enforced?
Of course. Yeah, no women were allowed in at all.
These changes also, we should mention, come on the heels of the Supreme Court's decriminalization of gay sex in India earlier this month. What's motivating India's Supreme Court to make all these changes?
There is a lot of change in the air, and I think they can't ignore that the whole world is rising up about gender and minority rights. And we don't want to be seen as a backward patriarchal society. And this Supreme Court is quite progressive. Also, our Chief Justice is retiring at the end of this week. So all these hefty matters, I think he wants to leave a legacy, and more power to him because it's finally bringing us and women, minorities, into the realm of having equal rights.
Reporter Chavi Sachdev on the streets of a rainy Mumbai. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Marco.
Gender equality is also on the agenda at this year's United Nations General Assembly in New York. Here's New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern speaking at the UN today about some of the ways that women around the world face an uphill battle, starting with the gender pay gap.
We still have a gender pay gap, an overrepresentation of women in low-paid work, and domestic violence. And we are not alone. It seems surprising that in this modern age we have to recommit ourselves to gender equality, but we do. And I, for one, will never celebrate the gains we have made for women domestically, while internationally other women and girls experience a lack of the most basic opportunities and dignity. Me too must become we too. We are all in this together.
Me too must become we too. Ardern said there's still a lot of work to be done in New Zealand on gender equality, as well as in the rest of the world. Her comments there actually came in a larger discussion about global cooperation. Ardern said New Zealand's engagement with the rest of the world helps to shape her country's identity.
I am a child of the 80s. a period in New Zealand's history where we didn't just observe international events, we challenged them. Whether it was apartheid in South Africa or nuclear testing in the Pacific, I grew up learning about my country and who we were by the way that we reacted to international events.
Jacinda Ardern's message was a striking contrast to what President Donald Trump had to say about globalism. He spoke at the UN on Tuesday. In fact, Ardern was bestowed with the nickname the Anti-Trump by the editors at Vogue magazine earlier this year. Wherever there's an election these days, you can expect to hear warnings about online meddling and fake news. And that's exactly what we're hearing about Sunday's referendum in Macedonia. The former Yugoslav Republic is holding a vote on a proposal to change its official name. But according to one election monitoring group, there's an active online campaign aimed at keeping Macedonians away from the polls on Sunday. Fabrice Potier is a former NATO official, now with the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity, the group that issued the warning. He says there's a lot at stake with the Macedonian vote.
It's basically about whether Macedonia finally closes a fairly long chapter of its recent history, a dispute with Greece, which has kept Macedonia from being able to join both the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, but also down the line, the European Union.
Briefly describe, if you would, the dispute.
Basically, the Greeks are arguing that Macedonia is the name of one of their regions in the northern part of Greece, the region of birth of Philip of Macedonia, who was the father of the great Alexander. So this is why it's deeply entrenched in the Greek culture.
Mm.
So it has been, you know, a dispute going on for more than 27 years. And finally, both governments came to a compromise where now Macedonia would be called the Republic of North Macedonia. And the vote on Sunday is about deciding if the majority of the electors, the voters in Macedonia, agree with that name change.
What evidence have you seen to suggest voter suppression on social media, and what form is it taking?
A bit more than a month ago, when we started monitoring, we noticed an uptick in basically creation of new accounts on both Twitter, but also on Facebook. So this is the typical early sign that there is going to be an orchestrated campaign, at least on social media, to start pumping in fake or distorted news. And then recently, we saw that these accounts were basically deployed very actively to take part in the online conversation. And our evidence is that they represent a bit more than 10% of the online conversation, which is more than what we have identified for elections in Mexico or in Italy. So 10% doesn't necessarily sound big, but if you compare it to other quite big elections, then you realize that this is pretty significant.
And Fabrice, what kind of messages have you seen on social media? And are those messages an effort to sway the referendum one way or the other?
It's mostly to sway people from not going to vote. So the main narrative that has been pushed through is about boycotting the voting day. The reason is simple. If the threshold of 50% voters turnout is not reached, the referendum will not be validated.
Gotcha.
So I think those who are behind this information campaign understood that the easiest target for them is to get people not to turn out, and then the referendum is nil.
So is there any indication where this influence campaign is originating, and who would stand to gain from people not turning out to vote in Macedonia?
Well, I think there are kind of two parts to your question. First, there's some clear evidence that this is coming from one or a kind of group of actors. We cannot say with 100% assurance yes. And that's why we stayed away from naming any group or any country. However, and that's the second part of your question, if you put this disinformation campaign with the fact that there are proven evidence of covert financial operations and campaign to finance some anti-vote groups and parties, if you look at and read what the U.S. Defense Secretary Mattis said when he went to Skopje some few weeks ago, naming Russia as actively engaged in trying to discourage people from voting, if you put all these elements together, I think the fingers clearly point ultimately towards Russia, who is the one who has the most to lose in Macedonia joining NATO?
And with both those outcomes, joining NATO and the EU, how would Russia respond?
Well, I think Russia is already responding, or at least it's trying to respond. And you know, it's the same with Montenegro. They did everything to undermine the integrity of the institutions in Montenegro in order for Montenegro not to be invited to join NATO. They failed, and now Montenegro is a member of the alliance, which is a good thing. So I think it would be about probably Russia turning to, you know, whatever is the next battle. And I can tell you that obviously they are going to focus much more on Ukraine, which is not a member of NATO nor of the EU, but whose elections next year are going to be very critical to the future of this country.
Fabrice Potier, senior advisor for the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity, speaking with us from Brussels. Thank you.
Pleasure.
And before we take a break, it's a cliche to say you don't get to choose who you fall in love with. Still, it makes for a compelling premise of a film that's screening in Kenya this week, and only this week.
The film is a love story about two young girls who fall in love and the way the community changes as a result of it.
That's director Wanuri Kahiu. The film is called Rafiki, which means friend in Swahili. It's about two women in love. They're the daughters of politicians from Nairobi. Their friends and families don't approve of the relationship and their sexuality. Earlier this year, Rafiki became the first Kenyan film to premiere at Cannes, but in Kenya, the government had banned it. Under Kenyan law, anyone engaging in gay or lesbian activity could face up to 14 years in prison. Wanuri Kahiu says it was the ending of her film specifically that the authorities took issue with.
When I refused to change the ending, they banned the film, which meant that the film could not be distributed, broadcast, exhibited, or possessed.
Kahiu says what she was going for with Rafiki was something groundbreaking, something to help fix the way queer communities are represented in Kenya.
We're seeing the systematic erasure of people on screen. There has been a history of the systematic erasure of people, rather. And now we get to see communities that we hadn't seen before. And we get to see them in power, in joy, in love, as part of a hopeful image of the Africa that we want to be part of.
Kahiu went to court to get the ban on her film overturned. She argued that it violated her right to free speech under Kenya's constitution. A judge agreed, saying she was not convinced that Kenya is such a weak society that its moral foundation will be shaken by seeing such a film. The ban was lifted for a week only this week, and only for people over the age of 18. The Kenyan government was probably hoping to limit the publicity around the film with that scheme, but because Rafiki is being screened in its country of origin prior to the Academy Awards September 30th deadline, it will now qualify for a bid for the 2019 Best Foreign Language Oscar. In Kenya this week, theaters have been packed.
This week has been incredible. It's just been so heartwarming. I truly haven't stopped crying.
Wanuri Kahiu is going back to court, but as part of a consortium of artists who are trying to save future filmmakers in Kenya from going through what Kahiu did and prevent them from being silenced, threatened, or sent to prison. Groupies come in all forms and nationalities. So here's a story about a groupie, a key figure in the Russian-Soviet counterculture. Okay, more specifically, this guy was the Soviet Union's number one Beatles fan. His name was Nikolai Vasin. Vasin took his own life last month at the age of 73. But earlier this year, Charles Maynes had a chance to meet him.
There are Beatles fans, and then, of course, there are Beatles fans. Nikolai Vasin was definitely the latter. Stepping into his small Beatles museum in central St. Petersburg, you find a paunchy bearded guy with long scraggly hair, usually listening to, surprise, the Beatles, although he'd argued the solo albums counted too. And there among the stacks of books, dolls, pillows, signs, shirts, guitars, posters, and roughly 850 tracks written and performed by the Beatles, after all, outtakes counted too. There, Nikolai Vasin, or Kolia as everyone called him, would point to a strange teepee-like structure, which he'd proudly say was a model for his true life's work as president of the yet-to-be-constructed Church of John Lennon. Now that's a lot to take in, which is maybe why Kolia would insist the story began much earlier, in 1957. Коля was 13, living in the outskirts of St. Petersburg, which back in the USSR was called Leningrad. And one day on his way home from school, a friend pulled him aside and showed him what looked like a 45 vinyl record, a 7-inch. Only it was floppy, translucent, and looked kind of like an X-ray.
I held it up to the light and saw Pons. I'd never seen anything like it. So original, so unusual. It was music on an X-ray, music made on bones.
Charles, this is Marco in Boston. I just got to jump in here real quick. So you can burn music on an X-ray? Is that what Kolya is saying?
Yeah, it turns out you can. The Soviets could be really remarkably innovative about trying to find ways around some of the rules that existed of the day, and burning X-ray recordings was one of them. So primarily in the 1950s, but basically until the arrival of tape machines in the early 1960s, you know, bootleggers would make these homemade gramophone pressings by cutting recordings into the only material that they had that was suitable and available, which is namely discarded X-rays from hospitals.
Wow.
And so this, you know, bone music, sometimes it's called bone music, sometimes it's called music on ribs, or the Russian would be Rentgen ist das, that's X-ray publishing. You know, this was a way for Soviets to get access to band culture, band music. So rock and roll, jazz, prison songs, music from emigres outside the Soviet Union, anything that was really suspect in the eyes of the Soviet authorities.
Remarkable. So what was on this X-ray record, this bone music?
Well, I don't want to spoil it, so okay. I think it's a song that most people will recognize.
That sound, Little Richard's voice, I was blown away. As a little boy, I was always scared of everyone, so quiet and shy. And then I heard rock and roll. And my life changed.
It would change even more, Kolya said, in 1964. By then, Kolya was an avid hunter of rock and roll records on the Soviet black market. And one day, a neighbor invited him over to check out another rare item, a shortwave radio. As they twisted the knobs, they caught a fuzzy transmission.
These adorable idiots are doing more rabbiting than singing, so.
From the BBC.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog.
Свобода. Это свобода была.
It was the sound of freedom. And after that, whenever I heard the Beatles, I took off my comfortable communist youth leak tie and put it away.
Мама все время кричала, Коля, сделай потише!
His mother would say, turn it down, Коля, turn it down. But the volume, that was about to get even louder.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world.
The Beatles' sound was changing, becoming harder, more political, and Kolya and the Soviet Union's politics were changing along with them. The push to open up Soviet society, for a spell in the 60s, and then later under Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika reforms in the 80s, stemmed from Russians' desire to be who they wanted, listen to what they wanted, Kolya said. And that wasn't the Soviet leadership, or for that matter, state-approved communist kitsch.
Перестройка-то откуда пошла? От рок-н-ролла?
Перестройка. Where did it come from? From rock and roll. First there was Little Richard. Then came John Lennon and his Beatles. And then later there was Russian rock. But rock and roll opened the whole world to us. It tore down the Iron Curtain.
For Kolya, the end of the USSR brought disappointments.
Но все равно от этого не уйти. Россия – испорченная страна.
He felt the new Russia never quite shed its Soviet past. Never mind, it gave Kolya the chance to visit Liverpool, connect with Beatles fans the world over, even once get a bear hug from Paul McCartney.
Да вот, смотри, висит фотография. Мы с Полем обнялись, когда Пол Маккартни приезжал.
But of course, he never met his favorite Beatle, which brings us back to Kolya's life's goal, to build the Church of John Lennon. The vision came to him on what would have been John's 50th birthday, 10 years after Lennon's assassination in New York.
We need the temple. Come together, right now, our temple.
Only it was imagined in physical form.
Imagine there's no country.
Не будет денег, не будет ничего, будет братство людей, о чем поет Джон Леннон.
A place with no religion, no countries, no borders.
Just a brotherhood of men.
A brotherhood of men.
Only some temples need more than love. They need financing, something Kolya had lobbied the government in St. Petersburg over for more than 25 years. The fact that the money never came through is said to have played a role in his suicide.
Так все может изменить, конечно. Вот увидите, мы построим храм и...
But the day I saw Kolya, he was still optimistic. He said if the Church of John Lennon was ever built, John and the Beatles, they would change everything. Everything once again.
I hope someday you'll join us. And the world will live as one.
And the world will be as one.
Well, that is a fine way to conclude this week. Nikolai Kolya, Vasin, the number one Beatles fan in the former Soviet Union. He was speaking with Charles Maines. Vasin died last month in St. Petersburg. He was 73. And that'll do it for us. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. And I'm Marco Werman from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. We'll see you back here on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.